recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Welcome back to another episode of Infamous Indie's exclusive three-part series, Digging Up Dillinger, The Truth Behind the Exhumation. In this part two, we sit down with the Dillinger nephews, as well as the former FBI agent Stuart Fillmore and local documentary filmmaker Scott Olmsted. You will not only hear in their own words the details about why they wanted to unearth their dead uncle, but also what happened with the History Channel, and more importantly, what they're doing now as next steps to keep this story going. I talked about this last episode, but I'm going to talk about it again here. The fact that we are all together in a room talking about this is nothing short of fate. It is a mystery that's 86 years in the making. Yet here we are in 2020 talking about what the family is doing to solve two of the biggest mysteries of history. This exclusive content has never been released, and the information in this podcast is new. Thanks again for listening. We will see you at the end of the episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. And I'm your host, Joe Melillo, and I'm back. I'm back with a vengeance here with an incredible Infamous Indie story. Friends of mine gathered around this table here to talk about a story that many people know about John Dillinger. But we're going to give you the background, and more importantly, I'm going to let the family, Mike and Travis Thompson, tell their story in their own words for however long this is going to take. So buckle up, get excited. This is going to be very interesting. We are going to go into the depths of where they have been living for the last 4 years. You may have heard of it. It was worldwide news, global news when it broke, that the family was going to exhume the body of John Dillinger out of Crown Hill Cemetery in Indianapolis. Monstrous news here for anybody who knows anything about Indianapolis. So when that news broke, the family was not able to tell their side of the story. They were under a non-disclosure agreement, hence why they were working with the History Channel. So now that that non-disclosure agreement has been ended, they have the ability to talk about what happened over the last 2 years that led them to go to court, to want to exhume the body. And honestly, let's get this story right. And what better way, and what an Infamous Indie way to do it, where I talk to them directly and they are sitting by me right now, a smile, a couple of drinks in our hands. We got some really cool guests. So let's go around the table and introduce ourselves. We'll start with Travis.
Hello, I'm Travis Thompson. I'm John Dillinger's great nephew.
Hi, I'm Mike Thompson, John Dillinger's nephew.
Hi, I'm Scott Olmsted. I'm a local filmmaker.
I'm Stuart Fillmore. I'm a retired FBI agent.
And we're gonna get into how everybody knows each other, but this is a ragtag group of guys who are just interested in some huge mystery, historical mystery. And as we go into this, It'll shed the light on what has been known and then what has been unknown and what they couldn't speak about before. So I'm so excited for everybody to be here. Thank you. You guys all had a hand in some way in the last couple of years, and we're kind of gathered here to get the record straight. And one of the first things that we want to talk about is, Travis, your interest in your uncle, great uncle.
Yes.
Is unlike anybody else. And really, that's what kind of led us down to this path. You started looking into the files, the FBI files. You had a question. What started this all for you, that interest You can even go back a little further than what I'm talking about, but...
Well, it started when I was a little boy growing up with my grandmother, Frances Thompson, which was John Dillinger's baby sister. You know, I'd be visiting grandparents' house and see the black and white photo that everyone has seen of John holding the wooden gun and the Thompson machine gun with that, you know, that smirk on his face. And I'd ask questions, and then I seen the movie, the 70s movie, Dillinger, which Grandma hated it and told me that that was a very false sort of dad. And then later on, as I got older, I got more interested in the story. And then I got in law enforcement in 2002. And while I was learning all that in law enforcement, I started really starting to look into what my great uncle was doing, you know, why was he so famous and why everyone always talks about him. I left local law enforcement and went to federal law enforcement in 2007. But during that time, I had ran into some FBI agents and just off and on, I'd asked them, hey, do you guys know about the FBI files? And they're like, well, they've been destroyed or, the, you know, water damage. And like, you probably won't be able to get any of them. So I reached out at that time, about 2008. I just shot an email to the Washington, D.C. office and asked if there was any files left that I could see. And I said I wasn't looking into what the FBI did or what they did wrong or what they did right. I was just looking for personal research of my family. And I never heard anything back. I mean, nothing forever. And I just kind of gave up on looking for those and just would read some books or watch some documentaries. And then all the way up till 2015, all of a sudden I got an email with the files, which I didn't realize at the time were already online. But I got the files, and me and my dad started going through them.
Because there's a lot.
There's a lot of files.
When you say a lot of files, what's a lot of files?
Thousands upon thousands of pages.
It's boxes and boxes.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, 80-something-year-old files you're trying to read. Some are redacted. They're blacked out. Some pages are completely blacked out. But we're going through there, and I'm seeing not only what my, you know, John was doing, but my uncle Hubert, John's brother, was in the files helping and was involved in a lot more stuff than me and dad ever knew about at all. And I'd be reading and be like, oh my God, look at this. And I'd call dad, hey dad, look what I just found in the files. And we'd be going back for probably every, you know, 3 minutes I'd be calling dad, hey, look what I found. And I send them to him, and so he's reading through some if he can't, what he could. And
I call him.
Yeah, hey, he'd be calling.
Did you see that? You know, look what I, because we was doing different. We were doing different files, so we wasn't both going through the same stuff. So I'd find stuff, he'd find stuff. So
yeah, we found, you know, hideouts, locations that we never knew that him or the gang was actually in, because we just were going off of family stories.
Sure.
So you wouldn't have what the law enforcement side was doing the entire time by tracking him in certain locations. And it was, you know, find out that there's money. There's, you know, there's some money out there. There's missing money. And it's kind of interesting because during the files, you're not seeing them recovering any ungodly large amounts of money.
It's not that big.
Well, the only amount that was ever recovered was from Tucson, Arizona, when he was captured. Other than that, there was no money recovered.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, so there's.
So that's still, that kind of piqued your interest. Like that was, hey, where's that money?
Yeah. Not only is the money being missing, like, oh, that's a big historical find if we could find it. It could be, but people look at it being financial gain, right? But if you could find it and return it, it would kind of help rewrite our family's name of what John did. Because we don't condone what he did. But he's a family member, so you kind of got to accept You know, it's in your family. You can't.
I think we all have family members that we would not necessarily condone. Well, so that makes sense.
One of the cool things he did is supposedly when they went into banks, he took some mortgages and burned them. So they kind of called him Robin Hood because he did burn mortgages back during the Depression. So, I mean, that was the only record they had back then. So people really liked him.
And, yeah. And you guys have told me before that you believe that he didn't kill anybody because there's a big debate about that.
There's always said that, you know, he...
Closer.
That he was in East Chicago and during looking through these files, but we always believed what the family said. You know, they didn't believe they killed. He'd rode home telling his dad, you know, not to believe the stories. He never killed anyone. And if it would have been, it would have been a shootout and it would have been an accident, but he never killed anybody. And he didn't, as far as he knew, he never killed anyone. Well, during the process of looking at these files, it pretty much is almost impossible when you get looking at these files. The FBI's got him in Florida. They know he's there. They're tracking him at the same time he's supposed to be in East Chicago.
And that had been after the time Billy Frechette and him split up. Like, she went back home or back to Chicago, and he was still in Florida. And this is the same day they've got, you know, a report of him in a location in Florida the same day of the East Chicago robbery, which there's no way to get from Florida.
Well, especially back in that day.
Yeah.
The vehicles, the roads, I mean, there's no way possible.
And you would have never known if it wasn't for those files. Being able to look at those files and pinpoint exactly.
Yeah, we were able to pinpoint a lot of different places.
The times and dates. And
even though all of it wasn't, you know, guaranteed that he was actually there. You know, some were just sightings. But locations of actual... It was really interesting to find real hideouts that they found. Or in the files where when John was arrested in Tucson, he shoved a piece of paper in his mouth before they could arrest him and swallowed it. Who knows what that was? You know, I mean, that has to be something significant. Why would you eat it?
Yeah, classic gangster move. Get that key and put it in your mouth and swallow it.
The files pretty much kind of opened it up to we believe more that he could have escaped death because it gives some doubt. Because before we always went with the family going, yeah, it was definitely John. But when you get to looking at these files and stuff, it causes doubt. Definite doubt that it might not have been him in Chicago when he got killed.
Wow. So there it is, folks, if you're listening intently. That is one of the main mysteries of the John Dillinger legacy, is was he killed at the Biograph, and where is the money? You guys covered it both. And obviously, that's interesting. It's fun, I mean, to think about it, right? I mean, we're talking about something that was the Robin Hood theme, right? Lore that he had. Now you guys are kind of digging in. This is what year again? It was 2000 when you first got the files emailed, 2015.
2015, yes.
Right. So now you 2015. So for the past, you know, that you start looking into it and then having fun looking, you're just thinking, oh, this is cool. We get to learn more about our family history. But then something happened where you were
in the middle of looking for the files, a production company got a hold of us. They had their own idea, pretty much a treasure hunt was their idea. And then when they found out we had FBI files we were looking at, and they really got intrigued. So then they was trying, well, do you have them all?
We assumed that we had them
yeah,
all.
Yeah, we got all we can get, and we hadn't even made it through all of them yet. You know, so but then they got on board, and we did some, I don't know, probably four or five different calls with them, video calls. We actually did them in the Mooresville Library set up. So, and kind of like interviewing with them, basically. Sure. And then so he come out and met us.
What the production company, what year did they get a hold of you? How many years did you have?
It was 2015 is when they got a hold of us. They got a hold of a week.
Well, after the same week I got
the files received.
Right after we got the files.
We just got done shooting a documentary with Scott right before the production company got a hold of us. So
2017.
Yeah.
Cool.
It was 17.
That was 17. It was 17. Well,
it was 2018.
Yeah.
2018.
Got it. So the reason I ask is that the timeline to me is very important, because we'll get into the details on what's coming up here in a second. But that production company was right there, right at the beginning. And Scott, when you shot the documentary,
mm-hmm.
what did you think about the FBI files that they were looking at?
I found it all very interesting, especially with the report of him still being in Daytona Beach. The East Chicago robbery, I believe, was like January 14th. 13th or 14th? 5th. 15th.
You could just say 15th. It. January 15th.
January 15th. And I think the FBI report that lists him still being in Florida was the 17th. Now, just to note, the FBI couldn't do anything at that point other than trail him, because everything he had done up to that point was state level. He had not done any kind of federal crime. So all the FBI could do was sit back and watch.
Watch.
And again, why didn't they... get local enforcement involved, law enforcement? Well, probably because they wanted to take the credit for the arrest. They were just waiting for him to screw up so they could jump on board. So it was interesting seeing that FBI report that definitely lists him in Florida on the 17th.
Is there anything else in those FBI files that you guys that jump out to you other than him being in Florida during that?
Oh, there was quite a few different things, especially my Uncle Hubert being involved. Not that he robbed anything or helped him rob anything, but he definitely helped John escape several different times. He was under surveillance quite a bit. And then there was the FBI. I called Travis one day. I said, "You ain't going to believe this. I'm going through these files. The FBI are talking about kidnapping my grandfather to capture John, to use him as leverage to get John to turn himself in." I'm going, "That's the FBI talking about kidnapping my grandfather."
And they redacted everything.
But it was right there in the files.
And you probably,
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. And now you're thinking, okay, whoa, whoa, whoa. Here we go. This is odd, right? And it's interesting, but what can we do? Right? You're kind of learning at this point.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Right? You could just kind of shake it off and let it be. But that's not what's going on. That's not what happened.
Well, then when the production company got involved and we got to talking and we started digging into files more and more and finding out more, then they come. I was trying to think, I think Paul first come and met us. And then he come with cameramen. He brought the crew and we did like a 5-day shoot. He actually set up a ground penetrating radar to go on part of the family farm. And his idea basically was all this uncovered money that has never been recovered is maybe in one of these places that nobody knew about. Everybody knows about these certain places they were, but then now we found other places that the gang was, and maybe the money's hid there.
In your opinion, Scott, do you think that the gang would have hid it in places? And Stuart too, you can answer after Scott, but where would the money have been?
Close by for a quick getaway.
You would think.
Yeah.
I would imagine, again, there's always been rumors about it. I read about rumors of hidden Dillinger loot back in like 1992. And it was always one of my, background fantasies. Boy, I really wish I could go look for it. And it's really cool because now I am. But yeah, I would imagine there's probably several stashes all across the Midwest, I think, because you'd want that money quick. You never know where you're going to be at. Again, they had hideouts all over East Chicago. There's also some evidence and some newspaper reports that states that there was money hidden up in Wisconsin. So, again, yeah, I definitely think there's something out there to find.
Stuart, how did you get involved with the team? Just tell the listeners before I want to hear what your thought is on the money.
Okay, on the money, at least, one of the things when we started this treasure hunt idea, my suggestion was, it's valid to search all these hideouts, because where the myth or the legend of this money comes from is there actually is about $200,000 in negotiable securities that were stolen by the bank, the Dillinger gang, at a couple of robberies that has never been accounted for. And so that's where that comes from. So to me, it was a valid thought that maybe we could search these known hideouts, and that, you know, using modern technology, we can find them. And when it was asked to me where we should start, my suggestion was we should start at the Dillinger farm, because to me, that would have been the one place that he would have had full trust that he could hide something, that it would be safe, and he could trust those that were there. The prevailing thought by the production company at the time was that we search at Little Bohemia, which is it was a lodge in Upper Wisconsin where the Dillinger gang was trapped by the FBI, and they were able to shoot their way out of it. And this legend of this lost money has primarily been that it was buried at Little Bohemia. And so I said, you know, certainly we should search there, but I think a more practical place to start would be the family farm, because if you think about it, Dillinger was on the run this whole time. And when would he be back to Upper Wisconsin? It's a long way up there. It's very remote. He might not ever see that again, but he's gonna go back home. Home is something that he's going to always go back to when he can. So that was my suggestion, and so that's where we started the hunt for the treasure.
You guys, it's so funny you say it like that. It's treasure hunt, but this brings us to one of my major points to have you guys on the podcast is you are not doing this for money.
No.
You are not doing this for massive publicity to be famous. I don't know. Mike, you look like you could already be famous, but
well, I am in my own mind, but
yeah. But you're not doing this for any other reason other than what?
We just want to prove that it's we want to prove there was John killed for one thing. We want to pretty much prove if it's not, then we want to try to figure out where he's at. I mean, I've always believed, just because of family, that it was definitely John. But when I got going through those files, and I started having a little doubt. I go, yeah, there's enough here that maybe that is not John, you know, even though mom and everybody said. So I said, so that it piqued my interest after all these years. So I got to think, maybe it isn't. Maybe there is some money hid. Maybe there's money at the farm, which I actually told Stuart, I go, John would have never, you know, took it back to the farm because he wouldn't have wanted to cause my grandfather have, you know, any more problems. And he told me that, you know, his experience that they always go home because they feel safe. And then I got thinking about that. I go, I mean, he's probably right, you know. And so that is a good, and it would have been something if he couldn't have got there that his brother would have got there to be able to get the money or something.
And Joe, just to follow up real quick, you had said that I got involved. Well, one of the things that when the production company contacted me, that they said that essentially these are Dillinger relatives. They want to find this money that's unaccounted for and return it as a way to essentially set atone for, you know,
the sins
of the past. Yeah, exactly. And so to me, that was, I thought that's a great idea. You know, it's valid. This money was never recovered. Hey, and it very well could be buried. It could be hidden somewhere. So it's a valid reason. And I think it's done for the right reasons, in that the family wants to make this symbolic return of the money. Because at the time, as Scott mentioned earlier, bank robbery was not a federal crime. And I think the FDIC was a brand new thing. You know, federally insured banks were a new thing. And probably most of the banks that the Dillinger gang had robbed were not federally insured. So this was, you know, and these banks are long gone. So who are we going to return the money to? It's more of a symbolic thing rather than a hunt for treasure by anyone. And yeah, we use that term treasure, but that's not really what it was about all.
It's more like setting history straight. Rumors aside, let's prove history. Let's prove that he was here at this time, that we could find the money this time, and if it's really him or not.
And that he wasn't in East Chicago. He wasn't in East Chicago. If we could prove it either way, sure, we didn't want to prove that he was there. But either way, we wanted to prove.
Because it's not, as a family, it's not just our history. This is everybody's history. So doing what we're doing, this investigation, it's for everybody. I mean, this is a way to show, you know, this is how history was, good, bad, or indifferent. It's, you know, it might ruffle some feathers. It might, but it's history. It happened, and it needs to be out there and be set straight.
Well, I think all of us, I mean, for me being an outsider from the family, I mean, my whole interest is it's a mystery. It's a mystery that's been going on for 70 years. There's always, from the time that he was shot at the Biograph, there was questions about whether it was really him. And the fact that he did have plastic surgery, it's complicated things. Was it a good disguise? Was it not him? And the same thing with the money. I mean, you're talking about a 70-year-old mystery that we're finally in a position where we can solve once and for all. So
actually, 86.
86. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm terrible at math. But
being a Hoosier yourself, this story is legendary.
Oh yeah, everywhere.
Yeah, I heard about it when I was a kid. I mean, that's what first got me interested in all this. I mean, I literally am, literally am like obsessed with this, and I have been since I've been 4 years old. My mom took me to see the Warren Oates Dillinger film in '73. My grandmother or my great grandfather at the time was out there at Crown Hill, and we went looking for Dillinger's grave when I was 6 years old. And of course, my mom and my aunt get lost walking to the grocery store. So we kept having to go back to the office to ask for directions. Where's Dillinger's grave? Where's Dillinger's grave? So we finally found Dillinger's grave, paid our respects, and 2 days later, the headstone was stolen. And of course, my mom looks at my aunt and says, oh my God, they're going to think it's them two women and that baby.
Three times.
Yeah. But that's what got me first interested in, and I really got interested into it in around 93. I went to the library. I got three books on it and started reading, and I started realizing a lot of the stuff I'd known about Dillinger was wrong.
Like what?
He's not a farm boy from Mooresville. He was a city boy from Indianapolis.
Yeah.
And him moving out to the country and getting away from his friends, again, he was 17 when they moved out to Mooresville.
15.
As 15. 1920, he was born 1903. That would have been 17.
Here we go. Keep it going. I want to see this fight.
Did you say your granddad bought the farm in
1920? Well, all I'm saying is everybody in the family always said he was 15 when he was when they moved there.
Well, still 15 or 17, that's still at an age where, you know, your friends are more important than your family at that age.
There was two farms bought in Mooresville.
Right.
A lot of people only know about the one. They bought one on the east side of Mooresville.
We need to check
northeast side of Mooresville. The first farm was bought there, and he owned that farm for a year, maybe a little over a year, sold that farm and bought the farm on 267 that everybody knows about.
Okay.
So
Stewart's
why he was probably 15, 15 and a half when he actually moved to Mooresville.
But I realized that he grew up in Indianapolis, and he grew up not too far from where I grew up, over on the east side. So there was a lot of similarities. And then I went into the Navy at 17. He went in when he was about 18, 19 years old. So we had that Navy connection. So that really got me obsessed with it. So
what do you think that the obsession is to this day from people that aren't interested in history per se? Even my 9-year-old son makes me listen to other Dillinger podcasts because he wants to hear about it.
Now, and that's pretty amazing. 86 years ago, John was doing all this. And
what is it about it?
It's because, well, let's face it, okay? America's been founded. We're all a bunch of outlaws, okay? A bunch of treasonous outlaws. So we always have kind of a little soft spot for our bad guys, you know? Whether it's Jesse James or Al Capone or any of these guys. And you know, make no mistake, all these guys did some pretty terrible things. But we kind of admire their bravado, you know, that they went out and they took what they wanted. And again, with John Dillinger, I mean, of all the people, you know, bad guys, criminals, or whatever, if you're going to idolize, he's probably the one to do it, because he certainly wasn't a sociopath like someone like Babyface Nelson. He wasn't like a cold-blooded killer. He was polite even when he was robbing you, which mostly was banks and institutions. I don't think he had a beef with individuals. I don't think he was mean-spirited or anything, but he definitely had a beef with authority, and a lot of us do. So I think that's probably it. And the fact that he
was able... Go ahead and
say
that to the FBI agent, or a former FBI agent.
I will. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, you know,
he probably knows it better than all of us.
John got a raw deal right off the start. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. He really never been in trouble. It was an attempted robbery. They never even got the money. And it was his older cousin that was 11 years older than him, decided to rob the grocer, Frank Morgan, walking home from the grocery store. A lot of people think he robbed the store. They didn't. He was walking home, taking the money to the bank. He's a big guy, old guy, but a big guy. He fought.
Yeah.
And some say he had a rubber hose with lead. Some say he had a club. You know.
According to his own statement from the prison record, it was a bolt and a handkerchief.
A bolt.
Yeah.
So, but Frank Morgan... And John gave himself away. After all, they got away. He goes up to the pool hall later. He's afraid that Morgan was hurt. And then he goes, does anybody know how Frank Morgan is? Well, nobody knew. So he kind of gave himself away.
His youth portrayed in a moment, right? We know why the guys to my left, Travis and Mike, we know why you guys like Dillinger. But what is it about Dillinger that sticks with you, Stuart?
So the 1973 movie with Warren Oates about Dillinger, I think we all have that in common here. I saw that. I was 8 years old when I saw it. I've always been fascinated by gangsters and gunfighters. But there was something visually about that movie. It was the cars. It was the suits. You know, not to glorify gangsters, but frankly, they just looked cool. You know, I probably didn't know that at the time to me. But also, you know, the G-men, the FBI agents, all were wearing the same suits, and they looked cool. It just was a really something just fascinated me about that time period, and I really can't explain it, but I've never actually lost that fascination. And so it was really, for me, it was, I didn't set out from that movie thinking I want to be an FBI agent or I want to be a bank robber. It was just a fascinating thing to me that I've kept an interest in. And so when I got to the FBI, I had been in, let's see, about 8 years, and I got transferred actually to Chicago. So I remember thinking to myself that, you know, I how can I get so lucky to, number one, you know, to make it into the FBI, and then, you know, be in Chicago where I can go look at these sites where all this stuff happened, the Biograph Theater. I actually went to a movie at the Biograph Theater, went on a ghost tour of Chicago, and they take you by the alley where Dillinger was killed and where the St. Valentine's Day Massacre was.
Allegedly killed.
Allegedly killed, exactly. And then going back where Travis is talking about in 2015, starting this hunt for the files, that's probably around maybe the same time that it hit the FBI website. And I actually had started reading that myself. So, you know, this was nothing that I had to make myself find any interest in. I was reading that file myself just in my spare time, because I was fascinated by the case. And being in the FBI, it was interesting to see how their reports were back in those days versus what I experienced, and frankly, they hadn't changed that much. It was very, very similar, and that was one thing that had surprised me about it. But I really can't answer you as to why the fascination, other than, you know, just Dillinger. There's just a certain aura about him. The name sounds cool. Number one, it's just a cool name. And in fact, I think there's a story behind that. That actually,
it's not really Dillinger.
Yeah, the family pronunciation of the name was Dillinger, right?
Yep. And my mom would tell you every time. I said, Mom, you can tell them, but they're not going to say it that way.
So the story goes that after, you know, the gang that Dillinger was in, started getting a lot of media attention, and the public was pronouncing the name Dillinger, that one of the gang members, Harry Pierpont, was kind of, you know, kidding Dillinger that, hey, they're mispronouncing your name. And the story is that Dillinger thought, well, hey, that's actually pretty cool because it sounds like Derringer.
Yep. Derringer, so, Dillinger. Yep.
So Dillinger stuck.
I'll tell you what the fascination is with the 1930s and the gangsters. It's the Thompson submachine gun. That is it.
Oh, yeah. Hell
no other gun looks like that. It's like the coolest looking gun with that drum on there.
It's the name.
Yeah.
The name. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
I love it. And I love hearing the stories, too, because I think if you're listening to this podcast, you have a fascination with Dillinger and the story and just the fact that even to this day, what he pulled off was just ungodly, just bonkers. Like, wow, you're going to escape from prison. You're going to help your friends escape from prison. You're going to rob all this money. And you know what? You're going to smile and wink at the pretty girl on your way out.
And you'll jump over bank teller windows.
And that's one thing when we did some book signings.
Yeah.
And met different people. They always had a story. Yes. It's either my grandma, my grandpa. I mean, they all had stories. But at Greencastle, I had a woman come up to me and say, hey, you're going to be here for a while. I said, well, yeah, I'm going to be here for a little while. And she says, can I bring my grandmother back? She was a bank teller here when it was robbed, and she would love to meet you. So she brought, so I'll be here. And she brought her back, and she told me, said they called her the gum lady because she always give kids a stick of gum back then. But she, and when she brought her back and we got to talking, she said, you know, I was really scared when that holdup was going on, but your uncle tipped his hat and was real, said the other ones wasn't that nice, but he was real polite, made me feel at ease. And I, from that moment, I didn't feel as scared, and he was a really polite guy. And I heard that more than once, you know, different stories, but you hear a lot of stories. I want to say one thing while I'm thinking about it, the movie with Warren Oates. The main reason my mother didn't like that movie, she hated the way they portrayed her dad. She said, I never heard my dad ever say a swear word ever. So she was really upset about that.
Well, so take the swear words out of that movie, folks, and it maybe is a little
And
bit
I'm not
more...
saying she liked the other, but that was the main thing that really
The way they
me.
Showed great-grandpa in that video, in that movie, he looks like some old beat-down man. I mean, even... We've got pictures. He's plowing in a suit.
Yeah, he plowed with
he
like a shirt.
He dressed very nice. And in that video, he's in a
overall
T-shirt.
Yeah.
He looks like an old drunk.
The old house looked like it's ready to fall in.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, my grandfather was, at the time, he had three houses in Indianapolis and a business. He sold
grocery
two
store.
House. Yeah. And sold the grocery store and left Audrey, the oldest daughter, a home because she was already married, and left her with that home. And he was kind of middle class, upper middle class. So, I mean,
he
wasn't, the house wasn't falling in and all that. So,
yeah, motivation wise, that the fact that the family was more middle class, upper middle class is less of a theory about why Dillinger did it. We all know why he did it, but.
You're talking to, you want to know about, you know, what is it about Dillinger, you know, what makes him so special or whatever. I tell you one thing, I think for me personally, he was a smart ass. He was a classic smart ass. And who doesn't love a smart ass?
He liked to rub their nose in it.
He liked to tease Matt Leach, poor Matt Leach. He'd make fun of him for his stutter. He would call Matt Leach on the phone and taunt him. And one of the stories that I had come across in my research was one where him and Harry Pierpont were downtown Indianapolis. I believe they were eating at one of the delicatessens down there. It might have been Loeffner's. But they saw Matt Leach come in, and they're sitting there at their booth. They keep calm. They're quiet. Matt Leach is sitting there, eats his lunch at the counter, pays the lady, starts walking back towards the state house to the state police headquarters. So here's Pierpont, and here's John going down the street, following him down Market Street, back towards the state capitol. So Pierpont wants to shoot him.
Yes.
And John,
he wanted to kill him.
John talked about of it. Pierpont was upset because I guess Leach had threatened or had arrested his mother or some of his family members.
Definitely harassed the family.
Yeah. So John's no, I got a better idea. So they wait for him to get back to his office. They go to the payphone. John calls him and asks him how the cherry cobbler was at Loeffner's. Now, here he is in the middle of this manhunt, and here he is taunting the state police captain, and it just one of the greatest stories ever, I think. So
I love it. I love it. And he's a smart ass. He was a smart ass. He was super smart.
He was very smart.
And he was a great ball player.
Well, and that's what it is for me. I'm a huge baseball
guy. He was a great ball player. Mom always talked that they said that he was good enough he could have played pro ball. Of course, it didn't pay that good back then, but what it does now. But it's still that he was that good.
I think he became more famous than Babe Ruth. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
So this fascination surrounds the reasoning why you guys are looking into it. That's the love of Dillinger from all the stories. I mean, everybody I talk to, everybody has a story.
Nice.
And it continues to this day. Oh, my grandparent, like you said. So that fascination played into a huge factor for probably why the production company guys got a hold of you, is that there is this national, still to this day, interest. I mean, to the point where Johnny Depp is in Indiana talking to your mom, asking her questions back in the day. I mean, I'd love for people to hear that story about...
Well... Actually, Johnny didn't get to meet my mom. I've got a cousin that he talked to that never let him know that my mom was still alive and lived right across town. So no, he didn't. After the movie come out, actually, I was in Danville, Kentucky, and they were doing a spoof on Dillinger. Yes. And they invited us down. Well, Mom wasn't feeling real good, so she didn't go. And we went, and a newspaper did an interview with us. At the Pioneer Playhouse.
Yeah, Pioneer Playhouse.
And we had a shirt on that I made up, the new Dillinger Gang, Three Generations. And so she put on in the newspaper, if anybody would like one of these shirts, contact, and they put my email. So after we get home, a couple days later, I get an email. My wife goes, this guy's wanting 10 shirts, said he's, Johnny Depp's assistant. And I go, Sam, I said, we ain't got any more. We're not making any more of them. And I kind of blew it off. I said, well, we get like next day. Well, we check in. This guy is who he said he is. And Johnny Depp wants 10. I said, well, we'll get some more shirts. So we sent Johnny Depp 10 shirts. He sent my mom flowers on three different occasions. She was in the hospital. And then when she passed, he sent flowers to the funeral home. And then when I got married, I just thought it'd be fun. I just sent an email. I go, hey, if you're around Mooresville, we're getting married. And I said, you're quite welcome to come to the wedding or the receptions at the Mooresville Legion. And when we got to the Legion for the reception was this big bouquet of flowers with this note, JD, and they're all going, well, who's that from? I said, well, John sent them from the grave, or Johnny Depp sent them.
Yeah.
You guys, that's great. That is such a great story. And again, connects everybody together. I don't have stories like that. I mean, I don't know. That's incredible. Again, to just circle back, I want to keep everybody on track, because again, today is about getting your story out and your words about what has happened in the last couple of years. The production company gets a hold of you. You guys decide to move forward with the production company and name the production company. I think they deserve some sort of recognition.
The Kinetic Content.
Kinetic.
And the guy from Kinetic is?
Paul Lima.
So Paul Lima gets a hold of you guys, and you guys start doing your work.
We start. Yep.
Is Stuart with you?
First time we met him.
That's when we met him.
First time.
Yep. And do we have a date? Do you remember?
It was April of 2018 when I was contacted by Paul. And much like you, Mike, I did the same thing with the video interview and so forth.
You're kind of like a little interview with him.
Sure. Basically. I think they wanted to see what you look like on camera and that.
But we didn't meet Stuart until June.
Well, thank God this is a podcast, because you guys are horrendous.
Yeah, we.
I'm just kidding. No, you guys.
That's why we usually keep the lights dim.
Yeah,
exactly. We have a face for radio.
I call this the Dillinger Den. You keep it low. You're the Dillinger Den. So you guys went through that interview. You probably were like, "All right, here we go. Let's start working to see if we can actually do something." Except for Scott.
Except for Scott.
Yeah. Scott.
Well, funny with Scott is Scott had done pretty much a documentary on John. And he, when he first contacted me, I was headed to Florida. I said, when I get back, I'll talk to you.
I didn't think he would.
So I did, when I got back, contacted him, talked to him. He did it. He did a great job on it. I thought he did a great job. A
very great job.
And what was funny, when he contacted me, that's when the production company, not like 2 weeks later, this guy from a production company, I go, do you know somebody? And he goes, yeah. I wish I had those contacts.
Yeah.
Because I'm going, this seems odd. I got this guy contacting me. I got this guy contacting me.
It was the first week of March of 2018. We come out here. I had three crew members of mine, friends from school. I was doing my capstone project. That's why I did the documentary. It was my capstone for my digital media arts and science degree. And I had Austin Congolanese and Ben Williams and Laurel Hayes. Laurel with us, and we were setting up. And Mike asked me, did you call someone from the History Channel? I'm like, no. He goes, we just got a call for someone from the History Channel, and they wanted to work with me and Travis. I'm like, oh, really? He goes, you sure you didn't call him? I'm like, no, but hook me up.
It just seemed odd that I get this guy calling me, and then I got this guy calling me, and it's all the same time. The production company, we had went to Peru, Indiana. There's
10
a bar
years prior.
Called Dillinger's. And a friend of mine knew the owners and said they would like you to come up because the whole town of Peru is doing this thing and they would love to have you guys come up there. So we went up there and met some people, met them. They're great people. And so from going up there, somehow the production company seen Dillinger restaurant.
Well, they had seen a newspaper from 10 years prior to that.
Of us.
And then somehow put us in that restaurant together.
So they contacted them. They sent me an email, and that's how I got connected with a production company.
What?
I mean, just down on going up there and them seeing that Paul said he got an idea when he seen a picture of me and my son at Crown Point.
Yeah, that Crown Point,
He was at Crown Point, and he seen that picture, and he said they were looking for a new show, and he said something when they seen that picture just clicked, and he had this idea, and that's why he wanted to contact us.
But so he had no idea that you had the FBI files.
Was just odd that he called because he had been trying to get him.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know he'd been trying to get him for a while, and then he told me, and then he got him, and then we had been going through him for like maybe a couple weeks. And this guy contacts me. And then so we're talking about it. And then while we're talking about it, I go, we just happen to have the files. We've been going. He goes, what?
Yeah, freaking out. Probably. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Did my work for me. And you read them.
It's great. Well, I mean, we dug through those files. So,
well, Stuart had some that they didn't have that. That's not even on the website. He got the complete.
Yeah,
complete
he got the good stuff.
Well, and again, another little strange coincidence that kind of, you know, all happened at the same time. Is when I answered an ad that was in FBI Agents Retired Association, Paul's announcement that he was looking for a recently retired FBI agent for interested in a potential show that was being developed, and possibly an on-camera thing. And that was all it said. And so I answered the email, gave a little background on myself. And then when I actually talked to Paul, he started saying, this is going to be developed, a show about John Dillinger. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of John Dillinger. And I'm like, well, you know, I know quite a bit about John Dillinger.
It was
something that was just right in my wheelhouse. And
just randomly.
Random. Exactly.
Wow.
Yes.
And
it was cool the way that Paul, he didn't want us to meet until he had it on film. Us meeting was, they had the cameras rolling. He walks in. He sat out in a car.
I went to the door and answered it.
Yeah, he went to the door, answered, let him in. But we hadn't met face-to-face until that moment. He didn't want that to happen until it was on camera for the first time. When we met. It was on camera.
A true production mind. Yep. Getting that moment on camera. Stuart, for everybody, I think it's really interesting. I think you need to mention, what did you do for the FBI?
Well, I was a special agent for 26 years, and then I was a support employee for 3 years. So I did a total of 29 years in the Bureau.
So you had...
And I was just a regular field agent. I worked mainly public corruption was my background. So I was an investigator the entire time. what's called a street agent.
Gotcha, gotcha. So you're a tough guy.
I don't know about that, but I'm the one I had.
You what, don't want on you.
I had what we would call them old timers, and strangely enough, before long, I became an old timer in the FBI. But I remember when I was a young agent, I had an old timer tell me that he had been on the street his entire career, and he was that's where the rubber met the road. So I, for me, that just was like, you know, I like that. I like the concept of that. I like what I'm doing. I like investigation. So I never pursued any advancement. I just stayed where I was on the street.
If you can mention any cases specifically that anybody would know, I mean,
not particularly.
I mean, we have a lot of crime fans on here, so, you know.
Okay. I actually wrote a book about a case that I had that was, it was really the last case I worked before I retired. And it was just about a corruption case in a small town in Texas named Tenahaw, which is the name of the book. I guess I'll give myself a little plug there.
Please.
But I worked with a Texas Ranger and an ATF agent on this case, and this had everything possible in it. It had sex, drugs, rock and roll, corruption.
All the good stuff.
You know, an unexplained death that potentially could have been a murder. It literally had everything. And during the course of this case, there were so many little twists and turns to it that the Texas Ranger I worked with and the ATF agent, we'd look at each other and go, no one would believe this. This is just unreal. I cannot believe this. This is like a movie. This is a book. Someone should write a book. So when I when that case was over, we generally would write a summary of the case to close out the case, to just say, here's what happened. And I was writing that, and as I was writing it, it struck me that, wow, this may be a book. So I actually just wrote a book about it, and it was a pretty interesting case. So, but beyond that, as far as just famous cases, you know, over the years, I was in had a small part in many of the cases. The first one that I remember would be the Oklahoma City bombing. Mm-hmm. I was in Chicago at the time. We covered a lot of leads related to that. When 9/11 happened, I remember working for probably about 3 weeks out at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, just covering leads related to flights of various people from all over the world. And then after that, I was assigned to what's called in the FBI a resident agency, which is a satellite office out of the Dallas division where I was ultimately, that's where I finished my career. The small office that I was in Tyler, Texas, was involved in the Columbia shuttle crash that was right over our territory. And so we were involved in the recovery of the remains of the astronauts. And that took a couple of weeks on that one. But again, wow. That was not my case.
No,
it wasn't something
right.
that, you know, I just had a small part in. But one of the most interesting things for me personally in the FBI that I was involved in, in 2000, just a routine lead landed on my desk to go out and serve a subpoena on a guy who lived in our territory. We generally have a territories assigned to us that's by counties. And the subpoena was on to a man named Bobby Frank Cherry. And as I read the information in this lead, turns out Bobby Frank Cherry was suspected of being one of the bombers of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, that happened on September 15th, 1963. Oh. And four little girls had died in that right. bombing. Over the years, the case had gone cold, but the Birmingham FBI office had resurrected it a few years prior and had actually gathered enough evidence to where they believed they had a case against Cherry. And so Bobby Frank Cherry had since retired, had moved to Texas, and he lived in a little lake community not far from our office. So served the subpoena on him, sent it back to Birmingham. I don't know, maybe a month or two, 6 weeks later, I got another lead from Birmingham that the grand jury had issued an indictment against Bobby Frank Cherry, and so there was an arrest warrant for him. And so the lead landed on me. I put together a team to go arrest him. He was an old man. There was nothing dramatic about it at the time. But, you know, and it wasn't just me, but I'm the one that actually put the handcuffs on Bobby Frank Cherry. You know, and we took him back to, and then he was extradited to Alabama. I mean, it's really routine. That is nothing, you know, I didn't do anything spectacular on that, but the one thing that just it actually kind of makes me emotional just to talk about it is the day that church was bombed was the day I was born. And that, you know, that actually somehow that I would, you know, somehow be born on the day it happened and then come back and ultimately put handcuffs on the guy that was one of the bombers. The odds
had
of that.
It felt good.
Well, but it was something.
As he has chills coming up.
It was something that was really, to me, was it just tells me that, you know, there's something going on that sometimes in life we don't see, but justice and truth has a way of finding its way to the light. And that for me, it was just really an important thing.
Unbelievable. Unreal. And this is why, I mean, I can see why they hired you right away, the production company. You're incredible. You tell a great story. I love it.
But what I told you is exactly how it happened. So it's actually easy to tell this because you know, I don't have to make anything up. Yeah. It's exactly how it happened.
But Stuart, when I do your life story, we are going to kind of spruce it up a little bit, you know, for dramatic purposes.
Yeah. Okay.
Make him swear a couple times extra. Yeah. You guys, this is great. If you're as for my listeners right now, we're about 53 minutes in here, and you know, we're covering a lot of bases, but let's go into what I'm really interested in, which is once the production started, right? You guys are back in March of 2018 here, March and April of 2018. You guys decide, okay, we're going to go full bore. You guys meet on camera for the first time. What happened from that point of all this positivity that we're going to do something to the end, which is when History Channel pulled out of the project?
Okay. Well,
so let's go March of 2018.
Well, it was June, which is funny, it was the weekend of June 22nd, which was John's birthday. We started filming. It was the weekend of his birthday.
Oh, yeah.
That's correct.
And we met, we got together, we started putting a game plan together of our start of our investigation, really. Right. When Stuart had mentioned we should start looking at the farmhouse first, which is good. My cousin owns that property, not a Dillinger relative, but on my mother's side, the relative of mine. He granted us permission to
let the ground penetrating radar come in, and then. Then we drove around. We got a little insight on Hollywood because, you know, do it this way, say it this way, do it that way, like maybe 10 different times on each. But anyhow, they marked all these spots.
Not to be dishonest, just
no,
to get
no,
a
different
shot.
Different right. ways of saying it and doing the same thing. But so they had us filming in the car, driving to there. Then they had all these. I think there was 18 spots or maybe 20.
I forget the exact number of spots. It was
18 to 22. I can't remember exactly. But so there's these different spots. So some were up like in between houses. But there was an area that looked pretty much like it never been developed. So just looking at that, it's probably a better spot to find something. More likely that since it hadn't been disturbed. So when he had those, so he looked at those spots, Paul did the production. So they set the cameras up. We did some stuff they wanted us to do then. So they decided we'd dig. So since I was John's nephew, he wanted me to dig the first spot. So I dig. It's a big rock.
Ugh.
A big rock. And the metal detectors are going crazy on it. So after that, on back was another spot. So Travis dug.
I dug, and I found a pipe. But before all this, we had ran out of time. We were going to dig more.
Yes.
Yeah, we were going to dig more, but we had ran out of time that day. And so we could only dig three.
So you chose to dig three, even though you probably had five or six.
We had more than that.
Yeah, we had more than that.
Okay, but, so Travis dug the second one.
It was an old pipe.
It was an old well pipe.
Were you excited for that old pipe?
No. Other than it was probably on the farm.
It was Stuart's turn. And actually, I don't know if it was Stuart or Paul, because that next spot they was looking at, the cameraman where Travis dug, all they had to do was spin around with the camera and they was already set. But either, I'm not for sure if it's Stuart, and he may know, or Paul decided the one spot on the edge of this ravine that was marked might be more chance of something being there.
I don't recall either. I don't remember how that.
I thought it was you, but I'm not for sure.
Was chosen. Yeah. It wasn't me. It might have been me, but I don't remember saying, "Oh, let's pick that spot because that looks better than any other." It might have simply been it was just the closest one to walk to,
and
Travis dug his, and so that's probably what it was. It was just the most practical one to get the camera set up for.
But it actually ended up being the closest one to the old farmhouse, to the original house.
Yes. It was about 50 yards from the back of the farmhouse.
So you dug, and what'd you find?
So I put the shovel. Okay, so first off, everything that we've dug so far, these are what are called GPR hits, which means an anomaly in the ground. Okay, and what that means is that there's something there that shouldn't be there. In other words, there's a disturbance that more than likely is man-made, possibly man-made. So,
but clearly, we saw a rock and a pipe.
Which
correct?
I got to talking to those guys and got to looking at when I was there while they were doing it, and they showed me on the screen. Okay, here's nothing, and then they'll show. Showed me what it looked like, and you could see it wasn't smooth looking like the rest of the screen. And all of a sudden, there's something. It didn't show a picture of anything.
Right.
It just showed there's something there.
Yeah. There's something there that doesn't fit the regular ground. So that's what these spots were, and so the technology also told us how deep approximately it would be. So this hit that we had that I'm the one going to do the digging on, they told us it was about 4 feet down. So I'm thinking, this is going to be a little bit of work. So I started hitting it pretty hard with the shovel, right?
Yeah.
So I think I did I put the shovel in, you know, kicked it, brought out some dirt, put it back in, hit, and then I heard a crunch. And the first thing I said was, wow, that sounds like glass. So I obviously I'm thinking we're going 4 feet here and I'm hitting something about 12 inches in, or, you know, maybe the height, the depth of a shovel head. So, at that point we backed off, cleared this dirt off by hand. We got a little trowel, started, you know, very, very delicately clearing this dirt away.
Everybody was excited. And, camera guys, everybody.
Yeah. So as we cleared more and more away, you can tell this was some type of a glass jar that, you know, is what I hit. So, yes, I hit glass, and there was some kind of paper folder, brochure. Couldn't quite tell what it was, but it was bright red and had yellow letters on it, okay? So, and I remember the word tour, T-O-U-R. I could see that. And so I said, guys, I don't know what this is. But there's something paper that's inside this jar. So at that point, I put on gloves, latex gloves.
Like a good FBI agent.
Exactly. Because I think I remember, I said something to the effect of, guys, we need to glove up because this is there's something here.
No, you
here.
Did.
Yeah.
And the camera guys were, I move up. I have no idea. I forgot about cameras. So I have no idea what I said.
And so at this point,
I see there's something.
At this point, a little bit of tunnel vision set in. And it's like, you know, you forget the cameras are there. And the focus becomes on what this is. So clear away more and enough to where I can actually take this brochure, this folder, whatever this piece of paper is that's in this jar. Turns out it's a roadmap. The old style roadmap that would fold up in the days before Google Maps and so forth. And people had maps in their cars,
and it's
right?
The United States. It's not a state map. It's the United States.
It's a map of the United States. So I
so very, what?
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm just kidding.
So I very, very carefully delicately open this map.
Oh, my God.
Because we don't want to potential fingerprints. We don't know what this
yeah,
is.
Yeah, you don't know what.
So we open it up, and it's a shell roadmap of the United States. And the date on it is, or the year is 1934, which for the listeners out there, any Dillinger buff knows that 1934 was a pivotal year in the John Dillinger case. So I remember seeing that, and I'm like, I just, guys, this is something. I don't know what we've got yet. So when you actually opened the map up and you looked at it, there was a mysterious route marked on it that
covered a pretty big area.
It did. So there were lines drawn between various cities that didn't necessarily follow roads. In other words, we thought at first, is it maybe railroads?
Is it a route?
Yeah. Is it railroads in between? Are these air routes?
Yeah.
Because quite frankly, the drawing or the route marked on it just didn't make sense as a route. It was zigzag. It covered from roughly as far south as Mobile, Alabama, Shreveport, Louisiana, as far west as Great Falls, Montana, as far north as Winnipeg, Canada. And I think, it touched on Indianapolis. But throughout all this zigzagging that this route marked, it kind of made what looked like an arrow that pointed at the city of Little Rock, Arkansas. And then by certain cities, not all cities, but by certain cities, there were dates. Unfortunately, no year, but it would be, it was typically in the format of, let's say, October 3rd. It would be OCT3. So that's how these were marked. And I think there were about 20, 23 or so dates, various dates marked on this map. And as I researched it a little bit more after this, the writing on it appeared to be ink, but it was somewhat irregular, the ink strokes that were on it. And what I found was in those days, they didn't have ballpoint pens, and a fountain pen would have been a luxury. And so the ballpoint pens of the day were something that were called indelible pencils, okay? And indelible pencil is something that to activate the ink on it. It looks like a pencil, but if you lick the end of it, it actually becomes like a pen, and it gives off an ink. Okay,
so it'll start to fade, and then
it'll
you
start
do
to
that,
fade. And you have to lick it again, right? Okay, so
DNA.
So at that point, also, I'll go back to actually the sequence of when we found this thing. So when I find this thing, we pull it out. I see it's 1934. I just glance at it. I just glanced at it briefly to see this strange route on it. We close it back up, get it into a plastic evidence bag, and it's sealed up. Okay, we want minimal touching of the thing. So then we carefully brought this jar out of the ground after that. Okay, and this thing was wedged in there. It had been there a long time. Roots over it. And that will have some relevance as we go forth about that. But so anyway, carefully extracted this jar from the ground, and it turned out to be a Ball Mason jar. Yeah. And if that's a plug for the Ball jar company, then they deserve it.
But it's not like the ones you see now where the one part comes off and then the other part pops off. The lid is galvanized, all one piece lid.
Right. And so unfortunately, when I put that shovel head down there, I obliterated the very end of it. But I would say at least half the jar was still intact. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, the part of the jar where you can see Ball, the way Ball is written. And so through that, we were able to identify that jar would have been one that would have been made no later than 1933. It was made through, I believe, from 1923 to 1933. So that also was indicative that, hey, this looks to be a real artifact. And so that was packaged up in an evidence bag as well.
No human hand ever touched it?
Well, not ours didn't. From the time he found
I'm saying from the time he knocked that glass out to putting it in that evidence bag,
as far as we know, nobody's touched it.
Right.
You guys must have been freaking out.
It was crazy.
The production company took the map for some time. So as far as we know, nobody touched it, and I can't see them letting anybody touch it.
And the lid's still on it.
And the lid has never been touched.
No.
Yeah, the lid is still
and
it's
got
intact.
And
which we haven't brought up, but when we were filming, and I had a bunch of photos and letters and stuff laid out, I have an address book that is John's. And in that address book, there's a lot of places that line up with this map. Wow. And there's phone numbers and names.
Wow.
Right.
So this is an incredible find. Incredible find.
Oh, it's incredible.
You just can't even imagine. Because the entire crew, everyone there could not believe what we were seeing.
I told them before we started, I said, man, if we find a horseshoe, you know, I'd feel pretty lucky.
From Dolly but and Molly.
I would have never, ever thought a map in a ball jar.
In the route, and from what you guys told me before, the ground penetrating radar was actually probably picking up the roots of the tree and not necessarily the ball jar.
That's what we believe at this point, because actually just this past summer, we went back there thinking, okay, was the GPR wrong?
Or
is there something even deeper? Mm. So we wanted to rule that out. And so actually with a track hoe that we brought to the site that actually Mike and Scott both operated in the course of this, we dug down to, I don't know, at least 4 feet, maybe a little deeper.
A little deeper.
And what's interesting, what we found was a good size root ball around 4 feet. Okay. So did the GPR
blow
see
past
that,
the map?
Right. Yeah. Did it see this root ball or did it see the mason jar?
And one interesting thing, the metal detector never picked up on that jar, on the lid. And I've got a cheap one. Once we got it back here, it picked up.
Yeah. Since then, we've actually found, I'd say, what do you think, Scott, 25 mason jar lids out there?
Of the same kind?
Yeah. Yeah, we found quite a few. Some of the other stuff we've been digging, again, with the metal detector and detecting, we found a couple of items that I feel very comfortable saying that, it was from the Dillinger farm at the Dillinger era. We found an old barn door hinge. We found a pulley. And then in another location close to where the map was found, we found another pulley. And a lot of old bottles. Of course, we find a lot of newer stuff, too.
Yeah.
And you found a shotgun shell, didn't you?
We found a shotgun shell, which we think belongs to a gun that one of the family members has now, a 22 that belonged to John Sr.
Wow.
So we still haven't found anything. I mean, I'm hoping, and I think Stuart's on board with me on this, is, you know, we're hoping to find a 45 or a drum or some cartridges that we could definitely say, hey, this was John Dillinger's.
Right.
Or at the very least, something that we can definitely say belonged to the Dillinger family.
Absolutely.
So
that's incredible. So that is on film. That, in a production sense, is gold.
Oh, yeah. They got the original find. And it, I mean, you can tell even the camera guys got very excited.
It really was. It was so exciting. Every emotion that was caught there was absolutely real.
So if anybody, and by the way, that hasn't been released.
No.
Yet. No.
So what we're telling you is something that is brand new news to my listeners and really to the world.
It is.
Because nobody has seen that.
Nobody's seen it.
But that's the rub of it. Because why are we being able to talk about it now?
Because our contract with Kinetic ran out the 1st of April.
This year,
the non-disclosure has went away. They're still in contact with us, but they haven't jumped back or the History Channel.
So one of the things about what we were doing, that this whole weekend that we're talking about in 2018 was to shoot what was called a sizzle reel.
This
is something that the production companies do to present to networks to kind of show, hey, here's our idea for a show and here's what it might look like. So that's what this was we were shooting out there.
And it was 5 days of 9 to 9 shooting.
It was a lot. But this, I mean, the high point for me personally was finding this map, because me it's like, okay, this justifies the notion that the Dillinger gang buried things that were important to them, because let's face it, this map was buried for a reason. We still to this day do not know what this route means on it. We don't know the significance of this map. The handwriting on it, where these dates are marked, I believe is Dillinger's. I've analyzed it. I've looked at the individual characters. with compared with known writing of Dillinger, it matches. It's a match. So this map was buried for a reason. So to me, this really gave us, to me, the credibility that, hey, we're actually onto something here that's really real. So if they buried this, what else did they bury? And you know, so we really need to follow up on this.
And it was,
and the excitement was sky high.
Oh,
it was
like,
you know, this is great.
And everyone involved was, you couldn't imagine, you know, you starting a show, doing a sizzle and actually find something.
Well, if you look at
Paul, everyone is this excited,
which is the guy, the main guy. If you see the smile on his face,
I mean,
all these other shows are hoping for a find. He's already got a find, and we're just doing a thing for the sizzle.
Yeah, and Paul acknowledged that he didn't really think we would find anything. I just wanted to give the idea that, hey, this is what we're going to be doing.
We marked these spots.
And then and lo and behold, we actually find something.
I think it's funny. We were all talking, you know, if they buried something, maybe it was in a pine box or a metal box.
Nobody was thinking a ball jar.
Yeah, a ball jar.
But it was something that would have been in almost any home back then.
Especially on
the farm.
Oh, yep.
Exactly.
So you got this sizzle reel pulled up. You guys, because the money is fun. Right? That's interesting.
Oh, yeah. It's great.
Cool. It's a treasure hunt. It's,
absolutely.
Right. So you guys put together a sizzle reel for the money to basically sell to
the treasure
History
hunt,
Channel.
Basically.
Right?
Yes.
And History Channel says, what? What do they say?
Well, they were on.
My understanding, and you have to understand, we were not involved directly in this
into the network.
It's the production company telling us.
So essentially what my recollection of being told is that... you know, that these networks have looked at this. They think it's fake. They don't think it's real. And I said, you know, I'll do an affidavit. I'll do a deposition. It doesn't matter. This thing was not fake. That ground was not disturbed.
No. There was no
doubt. Roots over it.
Yeah, there was no doubt.
This was not faked.
The top of that jar was locked in with roots.
This map is authentic. That's an old jar.
It's our listeners here, guys.
So anyway, in the course then of presenting this sizzle reel for this treasure hunt idea, it comes back that I guess some networks were interested in, well, there's another Dillinger legend or Dillinger myth out there that it was actually an imposter that was killed at the Biograph Theater by the FBI. From there, it came back is that's what the network now wants to look into. And interestingly enough, during the course of leading up to where we were, I had mentioned to the production company that, you know, there is another aspect to this case that is interesting beyond this treasure hunt, and that is this imposter theory. But the production company was not really interested in pursuing that. And why not? Why would we? Because we've got a real lead on this treasure hunt thing.
A huge historical find.
Right.
Thanks again for listening to part two of the exclusive three-part series, Digging Up Dillinger, The Truth Behind the Exhumation. Next episode, we finish our conversation with the family, Scott Olmsted, and Stuart Fillmore. So stay tuned for part three. Again, guys, I love being back. This is so exciting to be here and with you. I'm really, truly happy to be producing these podcasts again, and I'll continue to do the work to bring you the highest quality true content about true crime in Indiana. So until next time, stay safe.